Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 128 of the Intercooler Podcast. As you can probably tell by the fact that it is my, that is Andrew's voice talking to you at the moment, this is not going to be a normal podcast. It's going to be a very, very special one. It's not just going to be myself and Dan talking to you about whatever it is we've dreamt up this week. It is going to be the full unexpurgated interview that I did with a chap called Charlie Duke. Now, if you are a subscriber to the Intercooler website or app, and I hope you very much are, and if you're not, please go and take a look at the-intercooler.com and see what that's all about. If you do that already, you will know that, frankly, one of the greatest privileges of my working life to date was to have what I thought was going to be quite a short telephone conversation with this man, Charlie Duke. It turned out to be quite a long conversation. Charlie, for those for whom the name means absolutely nothing, because he is not comes from the world of cars, is one of four people who can tell you what it is like to walk on the moon. Only 12 people in history ever did it, and sadly, only four of them are left. Charlie was the lunar module commander on Apollo 16. He also did a lot of other really, really interesting stuff. I didn't know about his roles on Apollo 10, Apollo 11, the actual moon landing, and his, frankly, entirely unsung and crucial role in getting the crew of Apollo 13 home. So if you're any kind of space geek at all, if you just have a little bit of interest in extraterrestrial exploration, and I guess these days with the Artemis project still trying to get itself off the ground, people are thinking about it a bit more than they used to. Hopefully the next hour or so will be really, really interesting. Charlie is very nearly 87 now, but he is as quick and bright and sparky as he ever was. I spoke to him down the line from his home in Texas, and we went into everything, as you will hear. So please sit back, enjoy the next hour or so of a rather starstruck Andrew Frankel talking to a really very cool Charlie Duke, and we will be back, Dan and I, next week. Normal service will be resumed on the Intercooler Podcast. In the meantime, really, really hope you enjoy what follows. Thanks so much. How should I address you?
Charlie.
Okay, Charlie. Well, I don't know how much time you've got, but it's great to hear your voice. And I guess we will just get right in. I wonder, did you always, as a young boy, did you always want to fly? Was that the sort of thing that possessed your mind when you were a child?
Yeah, probably in the early teens, I decided that would be flying. Flying would be fun, I thought. And I got a couple of rides in a small single engine, airplane, and that was so much fun. And when I was 15, early jet age, contrails going over our city. And so, well, that'd be nice to make contrails. So I had that sort of desire. It wasn't an overwhelming desire, but a desire to fly. So, and that's what happened. So went off to prep school so I could get into the Naval Academy. And it would be my junior year in high school. Spent 2 years at Admiral Farragut Academy preparing for the Naval Academy. And then I got to the Naval Academy, and that's where I really fell in love with airplanes instead of ships.
So you joined the United States Air Force, I think at the age of 21, which was also the year that the Russians sent a satellite into space.
That's correct.
How did you feel about that? How did America feel about that? Did you think that it should have been you guys who were doing that? Did you feel that there was a sort of a space race and that you needed to get up to speed with them?
Well, at this point, I didn't think it was. I wasn't too concerned. I was shocked, actually. I said, "Golly, how did they do that? Yeah. We couldn't get 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 blow up on our rockets." And so I was stunned. I just soloed, actually. I was in flight school. I just soloed. A day after my birthday, this thing went up on the 4th of October. So it was a real shock. But the U.S. started really working hard. And I had a sense that we were in a space race, but I wasn't going to be able to participate in it. You know, too young, too inexperienced, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So instead, you went off, and I think you chose to go to West Germany at the very, very height of the Cold War. And I wonder if you could share your experiences being over there and just how, I guess, uncomfortable it must have got at that time.
It was tense a lot of times. I was in a fighter interceptor squadron, so our job was to intercept anything that came across the East German, Czechoslovakian border, anyway from behind the Iron Curtain.
Yeah.
If they had an unidentified object come across, we would scramble. And that was a fun job, actually. I enjoyed it. It was flying in bad weather and radar intercepts and it was a challenging job because of the bad weather in Germany. But it was worthwhile. I think that it was around a year ago, I don't know, 1961 sticks in my mind. It's when they started building the Berlin Wall.
That's correct. Sure. Yeah. It's the same year that Gagarin went up.
Right. And so that was a lot of tension. President, he called up all the National Guard and all of the Air Guard. And we'd had airplanes parked in every part of Ramstein. So it was, in a way, a lot of fun meeting these guys and flying with them. But also, it was a tense time at that point.
And did you ever get sort of up close with the Russians at all in the air?
No, the ones that came across were light aircraft and that we intercepted. I intercepted one airliner once and it was at about 35,000 feet and it was came right over Ramstein and we climbed out almost straight up to intercept him. And as we got up there, we identified say it's an airliner, but I noticed as I was coming up close, it was an airliner, but the bottom was funny. It looked like it had some cameras or something down there, but, which I reported, but, nobody got too concerned about it, but that was the closest, I came to seeing it was a Russian aircraft, but it was not was on its way to Paris, apparently.
And after you came back from Germany, you became a test pilot under General Yeager, I believe.
That's correct. He was Colonel Yeager at the time.
Uh-huh.
I came back from Germany, and I went to MIT for 2 years to get a master's degree in aeronautics and astronautics. And at 62, there were probably at least the second group, maybe the third group of astronauts had been selected. And so I was working on the Apollo guidance and navigation system that was being under contract to MIT to be built. So I was doing a statistical study with another Air Force officer. And there I met some astronauts. They were very enthusiastic about their job and about the program. And so I asked them, how do I get that job? And they said, well, yeah, you've got to go to test pilot school. First, you got to get your degree.
Yeah.
And then apply for test pilot school. Well, that all went on. I was working on my degree, but I applied for, you know, Air Force says, what do you want to do after you get this degree? I was expecting to go to some lab somewhere. But I knew I wanted to get back in the cockpit and fly. So I volunteered for test pilot school and was selected. So in the summer of 1964, my wife and I moved to Edwards Air Force Base, and I entered test pilot school for a year.
And there, and I have to ask you this, because to me, this is the most extraordinary looking aircraft I think I've ever seen. You flew starfighters there. And I wonder if they were as scary to fly as they are to look at.
No, they were a lot of fun. You had to be careful. Get behind a, you had landing flaps and you had a boundary layer flow over the wings. And because without all this stuff, it wasn't going to land at low speed. So, but it was a fun airplane to fly. We had some regular missions in it. You know, test piloting is not throw the scarf out the window. And, you know, it's very precise.
Yes.
Hold plus or minus 5 knots, plus or minus 20 feet, and get your data point.
Yeah.
But the flights that were the most fun in the 104 were zoom maneuvers. And we flew at 35,000 feet a full afterburner with no drop tanks on it. And so it would accelerate almost to Mach 2. And then you pulled up to 45 degrees and just let it go. And you could get it up to 100,000 feet. And you had to be careful up there because the engine was... the gyroscopic effect of the engine rotating wanted to tend to pull the nose off. And so you had to be careful on the rudders and ailerons at that altitude. But you'd come over the top and back down, and the runway was off to the left. It was the lake bed. And you'd do a simulated flame-out landing. And generally, the engine would restart at about 25,000 feet, and rarely did you have to land it dead stick.
And what sort of speed was it landing at? I'm just looking at those wings, and I guess you must have had to come in quite fast.
Well, I think if I recall, there were different speeds. If the boundary layer was off, you had a higher speed. And but I don't remember with the boundary layer and the landing flaps and all of that stuff. It was maybe 150 knots or something like that. But I don't remember exactly.
And in 1965, I think you saw an article in a newspaper or something saying that NASA were recruiting more astronauts.
Yes, that's correct. I graduated from test pilot school and. I think it was July of 65. I went to work for Colonel Yeager. I was on his staff for the astronautic side of the business. And
I ask, what was he like to work with? I mean, he's obviously, you know, to us, he is a legend. I just wonder what he was like as a man to get along with.
He could be pretty firm, but I enjoyed working for him. I thought he was a good mentor. He'd give you a project. This is what I want you to do, and this is the course I want to write the curriculum for this course. And so it was sort of right up my alley. And to be honest, he never interfered. We had some senior instructors who were closer to us than Jaeger. It was a busy job being commandant. And of course, then he was also did a lot of appearances, and he traveled a lot. But he was a nice guy to work with. He became a close friend. And as I got older, and I progressed up the ranks, we both ended up as brigadier general. And he loved to hunt like I did, so we hunt together. One was just a conference, and one was a hunt. We'd see one each other a couple of times a year towards the end, and then he passed away.
In 1966, you were informed that you'd made it into the fifth group of astronauts. There were 19 of you.
That's correct.
I wonder what that felt like. Did you in that moment think that you would definitely get into space? Was that a given by then, or was that still something which you know?
No, it wasn't a given. You were going to fly in space. You were selected as an astronaut. But you had no guarantee that you were going to ever get a space flight. Two of the guys in our group of 19 waited. Their first flight was 1985.
Wow.
So they waited basically 19 years till they got their flight, and it was in a space shuttle. But everybody wanted a flight, and you were given, if you weren't on a flight crew, you were given systems to watch over, if you will. I was assigned the propulsion stuff, and I was looking at the following the development of the lunar module engines, and also the Saturn V. Stuart Russo and I were assigned to monitor the development of the Saturn V. The way you did that, you got reports from Marshall. We would attend Wernher von Braun's monthly meetings, staff meetings. We'd fly up and fly back, and then we'd report to the astronaut office. So that was the kind of things you were doing. You were staying busy. We were also learning geology. They just wanted everybody to be up to speed in geology in case you got picked to go land on the moon. So
yeah. And what was Wernher von Braun like as a person?
I found him very humble and very friendly. He enjoyed having us there, and he was proud of the work, especially the Saturn V. It was the most amazing rocket. Never had a failure. So reliable. Never even so. I found him very congenial, and I enjoyed going to meetings. And you know, we'd have lunch together occasionally, and while we were up there. And I found him very, very knowledgeable, competent, yet humble and friendly.
And the Saturn V itself, I mean, I guess compared to any other rocket the Titan or the Atlas or the Redstone, this was a completely different proposition, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's huge. the size of it. You know, the other ones, like you just mentioned, they were two-stage vehicles. But the Saturn was three stages, and it was very, very impressive sitting on the launch pad. And the first time I saw it, they were stacking it into vehicle assembly building, and you just look straight up, and as far as you could well, to the roof, you could see Saturn V, and it was extremely impressive to me.
And then you got the job of being part of the support crew for Apollo 10, which was the full dress rehearsal for going to the moon. And as I think I understand, the support crew is not the backup crew, is it? It's a different kind of job.
It's the third level. You have a prime crew, the backup crew, and support crew. Support crew, you never have a chance to fly. Uh-huh. You don't train for the flight. You're the gopher. You know, get the checklist done. Get this change done. Go sit in on this briefing, and then you'd report back to the crews. And so, but it's a good job. I found it interesting. You monitored closely the development of the spacecraft through the test and checkout. Some of those you did, but not the. I don't remember having a spacesuit that fit me back in those days.
Right.
As support crew, so you never did a pressure check in the vehicle. But you did get in it and did some whatever test it was that the prime crew and the backup crew didn't have time to do.
And how did you become, because you were for at least some of that, you were the in charge of capsule communications, you were Capcom for some of that. And by that stage, I think you'd already started specializing in the lunar module.
Sort of, I guess. The Capcom came... let me think back now. I was also on a team that the propulsion division at Houston had to make a decision on the ascent engine in the lunar module. And it was on the edge of being unstable when you ignited it. And so we had a team, and I was assigned to this team to visit contractors and make a decision. Are we okay with the present engine, or should we need a new contractor? And if I remember, that was about 6 months. And we reported to the program manager, George Lowe, and it was almost unanimous. We need to change contractors. So we did, and the basic engine was good, but it was just the injector plates. It was unstable when it ignited. So, that was sort of an additional duty, during the time when I was a support crew, if I recall that timing. And so we were, as a result of that, I knew the most about the lunar module on the backup crew, so I would be Capcom for that active part of the flight where we would power up the lunar module and where we would, ignite the engines, the descent stage, the ascent stage, everything like that. So that's how I became Capcom on Apollo 10, and the rest of the team was going over for Apollo 11 to work on that first landing attempt. And so Armstrong and Gene Kranz said, well, you did it then for a 10, do it for us now on 11. So I wasn't support crew, so I wasn't supposed to do that. But they said, we want to keep this team together. So we want you as Capcom. So I said, saluted and showed up for work as Capcom. It's a very challenging 2 months.
And I think what a lot of people don't appreciate is when Neil Armstrong said probably the most famous thing that anybody has ever said, you were the guy on the other end of the line, weren't you? You were Capcom for that. And when they landed...
When they landed, but I wasn't on duty. We went off duty about an hour after the landing, maybe 2 hours. And then when he stepped out on the moon, there was another Capcom named Bruce McCandless.
Okay, but the landing itself was
yeah
I mean, you, there's a very famous quote of yours, which I'm not going to repeat to you now, but yeah, it was, well, there's a bit of it. So you got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot. That was quite a nervous moment, wasn't it?
Very tense and nervous. I think more tension than nervousness. If you can separate the two, we had the tension in mission control grew as we got closer to the moon because we were having all these problems. Started out communication problem, then we had a computer problem, then we had a trajectory problem, which led to a fuel problem because Neil couldn't land where we had targeted him into. So he had to level off and fly horizontally across the moon for a while. And that used up basically all our reserve fuel. So now we're minimum fuel. And so I remember, and you can imagine the tension. And it was, are we going to make it? Are we going to make it? Are we going to make it? And at least that's what I'm thinking in my mind. And as I look at the fuel levels on my monitor and descent, the height, and you knew it was going to be really, really close. So we had two calls in mission control. When the fuel got to a certain percentage, it was called 60 seconds. And then after that, the countdown, he called 30 seconds. And so the next call after that was going to be, at least for mission control, was going to be abort. But we landed with about 17 seconds left. And I'm convinced if we'd have called an abort, Armstrong was not going to abort 20 feet off the moon. he had the final say.
Yeah.
Now, if he was 3,000 feet up, you don't have a chance, so you're bored. But 20, 30 feet off the moon, hey, I got a chance at this, and we got 4% fuel remaining, let's have a go. Anyway, we didn't have to get to that dilemma, and we landed within 17 seconds to the abort call.
17 seconds. It's not much of a margin, is it? It's amazing.
No.
And then could you tell us about your role on Apollo 13? Because I don't think that people, you know, if people go and watch the film that they made in the 1990s, you're not in it. But you played quite a significant role in that mission as well, I believe.
Yeah, John Young and I were the backup crew. And if you recall, I caught the measles before the flight, 10 days or so, and was pretty sick. And at that, so they checked everybody out, and everybody had had the measles except for Mattingly, who was supposed to fly. So he got taken off the flight. Jack Schweiker took his place, and I'd recovered from the measles. And so they were flying along, you know, 55 hours away from Earth. And if I remember, it was like 10 o'clock at night. John Young called and said, hey, they got a problem. We got to go. Let's go into mission control. So John and I and Mattingly showed up at mission control. And if I remember right, we were there for the next 35 hours. And John and I were in the lunar module simulator figuring out how to get them back on a free return trajectory.
Yes.
And how to power up, what sequence was the power up in the lunar module. And how to control this burn to get them back on free return. And Mattingly was on the other simulator figuring out how to power this thing down and what order to power down the command module. It was never made to be powered down in spite and flight. So there were some big decisions. So we spent hours in the simulator figuring all this stuff out, and it all worked, and we swung around the moon, and things began to look a lot better. We were giving out CO2 scrubbers and the lithium hydroxide. And we were running out, and you know, the lunar module was made for two guys for 3 days. And now we got, no, two guys for 1 day. Now we got three guys for 4 days. How do you make it last?
Yeah.
So Mission Control got pretty smart and powering things on and off. And so John and I took a break and went home, and then we came back for over the next, let's see, I guess over the next 30, 40 hours, we were in and out of Mission Control and was there doing the reentry and jettisoning of the lunar module. And we'd worked out all those procedures which was basic, you know, the lunar module, everybody had to jettison it. But we'd never brought the whole lunar module back. We never brought the lunar module back. It was all either on the moon or jettisoned at the moon. And how is this thing that, and the debate was what's going to happen to this thing. And nobody really knew. It was, you know, because it wasn't an aerodynamic vehicle. So we let it go a couple of hours, I think, out. And it would sort would drift away to the maximum distance, if you will. So when it hit the atmosphere, it we never saw it, but it burned up and never came close because we didn't see anything and nothing hit the spacecraft.
Was there ever a time when you thought they might not be coming back?
There was, yes. I think for the first 20 hours after the accident, till we whipped around the moon and all that was going well, we began to get smarter about how to manage the systems, the electrical power and the oxygen and the water, the consumables that we had on board. The battery power was not infinite. And so we had to manage. And so it got really, we had to turn off everything because those batteries had to basically charge the command module, keep it charged, its entry battery. And then we got three guys in there breathing. And so we, in the movie, they captured it pretty well about how we use the command module filter to filter the carbon dioxide out of the lunar module. The lunar module one was round and now command module was square. Mission Control guys built a contraption. And at about that time, I began to say my attitude changed that, well, we're not going to make it. We got using up all this stuff, but we got smarter and smarter and smarter. And so now it looks like instead of running out 10 hours before reentry, it's 10 hours after.
Yeah.
So we began to relax. And my attitude came to, if Mission Control doesn't make a mistake and the crew doesn't make a mistake, we got enough stuff and we're going to make it. So I was pretty comfortable over the last 30 hours, I guess.
And then after that, you were selected as part of the main crew for Apollo 16. And just before that was meant to go into space, you went and got double pneumonia, I believe.
That's correct. I had been on a geology trip in early December in Hawaii, and I'd come down with the flu, but I was going to press on. This is an important geology trip. So I stayed in bed, missed 1 day of training, but I got up and but I just sort of slowly decayed. I went back to work. We got home, back to Houston. I was back to work. I was flying. We took a break off for Christmas, and then I wasn't feeling very good, but I was going to go to work. So I pressed on down to Houston, down to Kennedy Space Center, and I arrived there, I think it was Sunday night. The morning, I was so sick and weak, I couldn't get out of bed. So it was ended up double pneumonia, and I was in the hospital for a week.
And did you think that was it? Did you think that was going to be the end of it for you?
Yeah. Because, well, it's a possibility. I said, I got to get real quick. So at that point, we were going to launch in March. But something happened to one of the reaction control systems on the command module, and it required the whole vehicle to be rolled back into the assembly building and destack the command module and fix it. So that delayed a month. So it gave me another month to get well. And when they had that rollback, I said, well, I'm going to be ready to go. And there's not going to be any question about my ability to fly.
So do you think if the original date had been kept, do you think you would have been okay to fly then? Or was it that month which meant you were able to go?
I think I would have been healthy enough, but I'd have missed a whole month of training.
Yeah.
And would be rusty. I don't think they would have kicked me off, but because I recovered, it was just a while getting your strength back, and you know, missing a few hours of simulator stuff. But other than that, I think I would have. I hate to contemplate that, but I fortunately they. About February, they had this problem. And so, I was beginning to be okay at that point.
So I guess this is going to be a question that you will have been asked a lot of time, but I've got to ask it. The Saturn V, you can simulate an awful lot of things on the ground, but not what it's like to take off in one of them. And I've got some statistics here. It weighed almost 3,000 tons. It had over 7.5 million pounds of thrust. And the one I like the best, which I found on, I think, the NASA website somewhere, is that it burned more fuel in 1 second than Lindbergh burned in his entire trip across the Atlantic in 27 hours. So the question is, what is it like when someone lights a Saturn V underneath you?
It begins to shake side by side. It's not a pogo motion. It's a side by side, it's lateral, right to left across your shoulders. And when you think about it, it's like being on a 110 meter long limber fishing pole, and you're out on the end, and the guy that's shaking it's down on the other end.
Yeah,
and that's what it felt like. It vibrated, and Our flight had a lot of vibration, and I got a little nervous. And John was on the left side, and he'd flown Apollo 10 Saturn V, and he was calm. He said, "We're go, Houston." But man, it was really shaking, and I was surprised at that. But I could see the instrument panels, and you could do your job. And at shutdown of the first stage, we'd burnt, 4 million pounds of fuel, well over half the way, 60. So it was an exciting ride. And one of the problems on Saturn at this point, you can't see outside. Apollo had a boost protective cover over it. And so you're looking at the instrument panel and you can feel the shaking, but there wasn't hardly any noise from the engines that you could hear. It was a good ride. After that, it got really, really smooth. About 3.5 minutes after liftoff, they jettisoned the boost protective cover, and we were going in orbit, heads down. And so out of your windows, you could see the beautiful Atlantic Ocean, deep blue, and then that faded into a blue, a lighter blue of the atmosphere that turns into white and into black. It's spectacular.
Sounds absolutely amazing. And then I think you actually had a reasonably straightforward journey to the moon, but then you had problems when you were in lunar orbit getting the lunar module ready for the descent.
The lunar module was pretty good shape. We had one overpressure of a system that we vented, and so that was a minor problem, but it wasn't it was with a reaction control system. The big problem came in the command module. 1 hour before we were to land, Mattingly had to change his orbit, so that he'd be in a proper position if we had to abort the landing. And so as he was checking out the engine, the secondary control system was inoperative, and it was just wagging. The engine was just back there wagging back and forth like a dog's tail. And so he reported that, and John said, "Don't burn." Well, that was really, to me, I was stunned, and it hit me that if he doesn't make this burn, we're not going to land this vehicle.
Yeah.
It's going to be abort. And you can imagine 2.5 years of training, 8 miles above your landing spot, and Mission Control is going to tell you to come home. So it was really a moment of dejection, if you will, and, you know, just discouragement. But Mission Control said, "Look, we'll look at it. Y'all just sort of fly formation." And they, two rounds later, they said, "We know what's wrong. We can't fix it, but here's a workaround, and you go for landing." And hoorah! I mean, I tell you, our spirits lifted, and we were ready to go on the next rebel round.
And you were the lunar module pilot. What was it like to actually physically? Was it all automated, or did you have to actually manually fly the lunar module yourself?
Well, I was on the right side. I was like a co-pilot in an airliner, and we had trained so that I would keep us on profile, which is rate of descent versus altitude, and John would actually fly. But the whole till you got down to 7,000 feet, it was all autopilot. And the autopilot was flying it, but you looked to make sure the autopilot was staying on the profile. It did, so we didn't touch it. If it wasn't, we were going to take over. But at 7,000 feet, 2,500 meters, maybe a little bit less, the vehicle pitches over, and you can see the moon for the first time. And
what was that like?
It was exciting because we were almost right on track, right on target. And I said, "Hey, John, I can see Lone Star and Gator," which were two big 500 meter craters out on my side. And it says, and then I looked out to the north, and we were concerned about making it up north to the big crater up there called North Ray Crater. And I said, "Looks like we can make it up there. It's pretty smooth." And John Denny starts fussing at me. He says, "Give me some numbers." And the computer would tell you where you were going to land. It was a landing point designation. And he didn't like it, so he could redesignate and move the landing point. And that's manual. And so he slowly took over manual control as I continued to talk him down on this profile. And if we'd had any emergencies, I was going to handle those. He was going to focus on completing this landing. It was a two-man job. I talked him down, and about 20 feet off the moon, he levels off, but he's stable. He's picked out a good spot. And so I said, "We had a vernier switch in the cockpit that one click down gave you 1 foot per second down." And I said, "You level off, give me one click down." So we started down like one, and another click, which we were 2 feet per second. At about 6 feet off the moon, landing probes, which were electrical, hit the moon, closed the circuit, lit a little blue light in the cockpit, and said, "Contact." At that point, you shut down the engine when that light came on. And we had a big whoop, and we were on the moon, and we just both exploded with enthusiastic joy. Yeah. And I screamed, "Old Orion is finally here, Houston." Fantastic. It was really something.
But you couldn't, you couldn't just get out of the lunar module. And I think you actually went to, I think you actually went to sleep first. I think one thing that people may not appreciate about Apollo 16 is you didn't just sort of visit the moon and go back again. You lived on. You were there for 3 days. You were on the surface, I think for 3 days.
That's right.
So it must have been a while before you could actually get to go outside.
Well, we had they changed our flight plan. We were supposed to go outside, power down, put on our backpacks, check everything out, and go outside for our first excursion. But with that 6 hour delay, they figured out we were going to be awake 37 hours before the rest period if we did what the flight plan said.
Yeah.
So they changed the flight plan and said, okay, we want you to go to sleep first. So we took off our spacesuits, put up our little hammocks. I stayed on the radio so that I could, if Mission Control had a problem for us, we could respond. And we tried to go to sleep. I mean, but you can imagine 4 hours, 5 hours after you landed on the moon,
I can't
trying to go to sleep.
I can't imagine what it must be trying to sleep when the moon's outside.
Yeah. So anyway, we put up some curtains and turned out the light. So it was dark in there, but you know, your mind's just racing. And so finally I told Mission Control, hey, I'm taking a sleeping pill. John didn't have any trouble at all. He could go to sleep standing up, I think. But anyway, I took a sleeping pill and got about 4 hours sleep of the 8 hours. So then the next night, next two rest periods, I should say, were you were exhausted. 8 hours in that spacesuit is a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
So we took them out off and cleaned them up, recharged the backpack, and went to sleep. Slept really good.
And the next day, you became the 10th, and obviously to this day, the youngest man ever to walk on the moon. And I'm guessing you must have spoken to a few people who'd already done it before you. Given that and everything that you read about it, was it what you expected it to be, or was it just a completely different experience?
Well, I mean, you can't capture the excitement, but the experience was what we expected. We knew that the rover was going to come off good, and we knew what the texture of the ground was, and how deep you can expect to sink in when you walk on it. And so all of that was from debriefing from Apollo 11, 12, 14, and 15. And 15 stayed 3 days like we did.
Yeah.
And so they had a car, and so they briefed us and what to expect, this, that, and the other. So we were so familiar with the operations that we were able to, we just took that for granted. But the awe and the wonder and the thought, I kept coming to me, I'm on the moon. I'm really on the moon, you know? And the beauty of it, Buzz called it magnificent desolation. Yes. And it really was.
Yes.
We had mountains left, mountains right, open valley out to the in front of us. And with no atmosphere up there, everything was really, really sharp all the way to the horizon. Then you could look up and you saw this blackness of space. And it was just, I never got used to it, really. I was just in wonder the whole 3 days we were up there on the moon.
And can you talk to me a bit about the Lunar Rover? That strikes me as being an amazing machine. It was the first, I think it was the first electric car you went in. I think you left it nearly 50 years before you went in another. One thing that occurred to me is what would have happened, because I think you went quite a long way from the lunar module in it. And if something had happened, if it had got stuck or it had broken down or something, could you have got back? Would it have been possible to walk back, or were you absolutely dependent on it working as it should?
No, we had practiced. Hey, what if this thing breaks down out there on top of Stone Mountain, you know?
Yeah.
Can we get back? And so we practiced that. And the way we did that was NASA had a centrifuge and that went around in a circle, and they had used it for G training, but now it was just not being used. So why don't you guys put a cable on the end of that centrifuge and we'll put a harness on and you pick us up until we weigh 1/6 down here on Earth.
Okay.
And so, and we, they did that, and then they started to, and we started jogging. They finally matched the movement of the arm with our speed, and we figured out we could make it 4 to 5 miles back. Yeah. So we practiced it.
Wow.
And it would have been a lot more. Now this is a flat surface. The moon's not flat. At least yeah. not in our area, and so it's up and down, and up. You know, going up a hill, you sort of bunny hop. Going down a hill, you sort of skip. Going level, you sort of Frankenstein walk, and so it would have been a lot more difficult to walk 4 miles on the moon. But I think we could have done it.
That would have been a walk to remember.
Yeah, sure yeah. would have. Unfortunately. It didn't break down. We lost one steering, but we got it recovered in some mysterious way. And we felt more and more reliable. The third mission, they went 7 miles. I think they were 7 miles away on Apollo 17. So. And
what was it like to travel in? Was it quite comfortable? Did you got used to going around in a car on the moon?
It bounced a lot.
Yeah.
But you were strapped in, and you couldn't quite get your rear end all the way into the seat because of your backpack, but you could get back in and then you were sort of upright and you could see out in front of you. I was navigating, taking pictures. It was comfortable, actually, once you got in it. It was hard to get in. And you had your seatbelt that cinched you in really tight. And so I was navigating and John was driving. And it was difficult for him to drive because you'd come over a ridge and there'd be a crater, a rock, or something you didn't know was there, so you had to maneuver around. My job was to sit there and navigate from point A to point B and take pictures every 50 meters of what we were seeing because the TV doesn't work on the rover when you're underway.
It sounds amazing. And when you finally left the moon, what were your feelings when you departed the lunar surface and went back up to the command module? That must have been a very bittersweet moment for you.
Well, it was. At first, we didn't want to leave. We asked them for 2 more hours, and they refused. So then they made the decision. So, okay, we got to get off of this moon. And so John parked the car. We climbed back in. We jettisoned our backpacks and some trash. And then we got ready for liftoff. And once the engine ignited, you're on your way. And then your focus is now you're ready to get back with the command module. And so your focus sort of changes. Then once we got in the command module and then we kept the lunar module, I think, for about a day. And right before we left lunar orbit, it was jettisoned, the lunar module. And now your attitude is, let's get home. I'm yes. ready to, you know, we've done our moon stuff. Now I'm ready to get home. And we had a 3-day trip home.
And when you got home, did you think there was a chance you might go up again? Or did you realistically think that having done what you did, that was going to be it?
Well, we had a... an outside chance of going again. And that was, we volunteered for backup. They needed a backup crew for Apollo 17.
Yes.
So John and I said, John, this is a dead end job, but who knows? Maybe they'll break a leg.
Yeah.
Or maybe they'll catch the measles, you know. And so we volunteered with the outside chance that we might get to go again. Of course, it didn't work out that way. And then my next opportunity would be fly space shuttle, which John and Ken both did. But I left before the space shuttle was flew. I left in 76, and the first space shuttle was April of 71.
And how?
I mean, 81.
How did you feel when they, because there was going to be an Apollo 18, 19, and 20, but they canceled those. I just wonder how you felt about that at the time.
Oh, I mean, the whole astronaut office was very, very disappointed. There were some rumors of who the crew's going to be, and I think they already had the crews picked, and the vehicles were ready to go, and all it was the expense of flying it. But NASA got, I think they got real nervous about the politics. If they, in the last three missions, we've had, Apollo had been so successful, and even the Apollo 13 was a success in the sense that we got the crew back alive.
Yes.
And if we lose a crew on the moon, the politics, I think, might have caused the shuttle to be delayed more or maybe even canceled. So they got so nervous. I think it was a nervousness about we can't kill anybody on the moon. The six landings we've had have been very successful. We've learned a lot, and let's stop. So the decision was made to stop. Nobody in the office, I don't think anybody in the astronaut office agreed with it. We wanted to keep flying, but that was above our pay grade.
And that was, well, we're recording this in February of 2022, just a couple of months before the 50th anniversary of your trip to the moon. Did you ever think that in all that time, in that half century, no one would ever go back?
Yeah, I was... stunned, actually. I mean, as I look back, I said, why is it taking so long? But shuttle and the space station were achieving a lot of good things. And if you remember, President Bush had the return to the moon, the Artemis program, I think it was called. Well, eventually it's called Artemis, but they had a command mod. It's called the Orion program, I think, at that point, and which is Apollo on steroids. And we were going to go back to the moon. That was in the early 90s.
Yeah.
Thanks new administration, they canceled. It continued under Clinton, but then Obama canceled it, and the only thing that was salvaged was the Orion, which was the command module. And now we're building on Artemis, and I think we're going to be, but that's just the way the schedule went and the decisions went. I think it was not right, but that's what happened.
And today there are 12 men who walked on the moon, and there are four of you left. Do you keep in touch with the others? Do you meet up or catch up at all?
Occasionally, yeah. I talked to spoken recently with at least emails back and forth between Harrison Schmidt on the 17 and 15 commander. It's been now probably 6 months or so since I talked to Buzz, We've had conversations about, you know, this reunion and that reunion, things like that. I invited them all to our big reunion. We will have a couple of reunions over in April, one in Houston, one in Huntsville, Alabama, one in San Diego. So wanted to make sure everybody knew about it. Got an invitation. And I haven't talked to Mattingly. John Young died a few years ago, and so it's just Ken and I. But Ken is sort of just been unavailable for some reason, and but we still talk every once in a while. But I don't think he feels like he can be too involved with this reunion. But we'll see.
Yeah. And just two more quick questions. I should mention that the reason I'm talking to you is because it has been arranged through our friends at Porsche Cars North America, because they quite recently introduced you to their new Taycan, which was, as I said, I think the second electric car you had driven after the Lunar Rover. And I just wondered what you thought about driving that Porsche.
Well, it was really high tech. Like any other, you get on a new airplane, I get into this car, it's all this high tech stuff. And I wanted to figure out how it all works. So I did just a general overview, and I was really excited to have this opportunity. And I mean, then we started driving it. Unfortunately, it was out at our local airport, and you could only go about 300 meters, and you had to turn around. But it really accelerated, and it was great handling, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And so it was a great day of really fun with the Porsche crew.
And my last question is, when you look up at the moon today, and you think, as you must, I went there. I just wonder what are the memories that live most strongly with you today of that mission?
I think probably the landing was so dynamic. And you could see at a half moon, the Terminator is just right on our landing spot. And it was really exciting. And, you know, my wife and I have a lot of romantic interest, if you will. We still get love to see the moon. But the sight that I see mostly as I look up and said, you know, that was a great experience 50 years ago. And so I can remember so vividly so much of it, because it was not a life-changing experience, but certainly the highlight of my military career and NASA career.
Charlie, thank you so much for spending the time to talk to me about your experiences. It's been a pleasure and it's been a privilege, and I'm very grateful to you. And good luck with all the 50th anniversary stuff, which you're going to do. And thanks again. It's really been the most wonderful thing to talk to you.
Well, that was a bit different, wasn't it? We've not had an astronaut before on the Intercooler podcast, someone who's actually walked on the moon. It wasn't strictly about cars, was it? But yeah, I think it was worthwhile anyway. Hi everyone, Dan Prosser here. I just want to jump in and remind you all that if you enjoyed that conversation with Charlie Duke, Andrew's two-part feature is on the Intercooler app and the Intercooler website now, waiting for you to read. So if you want more Charlie Duke, maybe head over now to the Intercooler app and website, the-intercooler.com, to read what Andrew wrote. Before we finish this week's episode, one other thing that I want to play you. This is a very short clip from our Last Blast podcast with Andy Wallace. That's Andy Wallace, the Le Mans winner, the hypercar test driver. This is the guy who did 300 miles an hour, more than 300 miles an hour in a Bugatti, which is kind of incredible. And we recorded a Last Blast podcast with him. The whole thing is an hour and a half long, and it's available to listen to now, again, on the Intercooler app and website. Look for the video and podcast tab. This is a very short clip. If you want a slightly longer clip, a 15-minute clip, it's available on the main TI podcast feed. But if you want the full thing, an hour and a half, head to the Intercooler app or website, the-intercooler.com. Thank you very much. It'll be me and Andrew again with a more conventional podcast next week. But for now, enjoy this Andy Wallace clip.
The first time I ever had a proper car was when I got into Formula 3.
Yeah.
We were using Volkswagen engines.
Yeah.
And part of the deal was you were loaned a Golf GTI. It was a Mark II.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, Mark II Golf GTI. What an amazing car.
It was.
I mean,
8-valve.
Yeah, I had the 8-valve.
Yeah.
The 16-valve came along later, not much later, probably the following year. But actually, for the second year, I still had another 8-valve. I never did have a 16-valve. But I couldn't believe it because I'd had rubbish cars up until that point.
Yeah.
And this was just, and I thought it felt so fast. 112 horsepower. Yeah. And it, so I think it was 850 kilos or something, but it felt really fast. Yeah. Fantastic golf ball for the gear lever. And, oh, it was great. And we did lots of, I remember the one of the times when, and actually you only had it for, I think it was 9,000 miles. And if you got to that, they switched it for another one.
Yeah.
So I did have one GTR, and the very first thing we had to do was go to Vallelunga for a test. So I just I left Oxford and I just drove. I picked it up almost from VW and then drove straight to Vallelunga. And I did the oil change myself in the paddock at Vallelunga.
The Last Blast podcast is sponsored by Footman James, a car insurance company unlike any other. Footman James exists right at the heart of the car enthusiast scene in the UK, holding regular car meets, publishing reports into the health of the classic car scene in this country, and yes, sponsoring the best car podcast out there. Thank you, Footman James. To find out more, visit footmanjames.co.uk.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.